You're listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG. We're live online at kpcg.fm. There's also a live link at thetrumpet.com. Don't forget about our friend, the TuneIn app. It doesn't want to be lonely. You can use the TuneIn app on the smart device of your choice and listen to Trumpet Radio. Take that with you. This is Trumpet Radio Live for Wednesday. Dwight Falk here, Abraham Blondeau as well. And a lot happening in the news. We're going to take a look at some of the main stories, preview the Key of David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury, and then take a look at a few things that have happened on this day in history as well. Of course, Abraham, the big news yesterday, breaking news yesterday afternoon, was the terror attack there in Istanbul. And I was checking the internet, I suppose, like most people, and to just go and check the headlines, and all of a sudden, oh, 10 dead, and then the numbers increase and increase. And so right now, I mean, the numbers are changing, but the death toll is 41 right now, and well over, I think it was over 200 injured. So those numbers will probably change somewhat. And so this is really interesting. This headline here is from Fox News. It says, airports on high alert following attack in Istanbul as death toll climbs to 41. Airports in the U.S. and around the world increased security after Tuesday night's suicide bombing attack at Istanbul's Atatürk Airport, where ISIS is suspected of killing at least 41 and injuring hundreds. And so from what I could tell about this attack is they did it at the entryway, one of the entryways, before you get to the security checks. And this is sort of similar to what we saw in other airport attacks earlier this year.
Yeah, this is really interesting for the timing of it, but also the method that they use, because it is something that's very hard to stop, because just you're in a crowd of people just walking up to the airport before any security checks. So it's very difficult to prevent that from happening. And Islamic State did it. They've had a couple attacks this year, actually, in Turkey. If indeed ISIS did, were behind this one. But just for some, most analysts say that they have been focusing on soft targets. So an airport's a big one, especially for Turkey. Tourism is one of their top producers of income. I think 2015, Istanbul was one of the top places to visit in the world. So this is a pretty big blow to their industry, and it's also just really deadly too. It's I mean, there's been other big attacks in their history, but it's pretty deadly.
Did you see the footage of when that guy blew himself up?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing. Where, you know, people are walking and something had happened, and people are kind of looking around. All of a sudden, there's a big flash and then another one. And I mean, we've all been in airports, and you just think, wow, I mean, what would you do? You wouldn't know where to go. Which way do you run? Do you just get down? Do you run? And then if you start running, or if you start, you know, do people think you're a terrorist? Yeah, I mean, it's just chaos, and which is obviously what they're trying to cause, along with the death and the destruction. They want to cause that chaos and that fear. And they've been successful in doing it, because as this Fox story points out, now all the airports have to be on high alert. You know, it can be frustrating going through security and being kind of delayed on flights, but the airports are in a tough place, because how are you going to stop these type of attacks? I remember right after the 9/11 attack here locally in Oklahoma, going to the airport, Will Rogers, you know, the security was very intense, to where you weren't even allowed to really pull up next to the building. Or if you were, somebody had to get in or out of your vehicle immediately. You could not sit there and wait. And you used to be able to just pull up and wait for somebody there.
Right.
Couldn't do that anymore at that time anyway. And there were police officers all up and down. And, it was pressure. Like, you got to drop somebody off and get out of here. So they relaxed that a little bit, but there's still that presence there. And again, how far away from the airport do you have to make the security checks? You know, a mile, 2 miles? Like, what do you do? Because attacks like this keep happening.
Yeah, it's really putting established nations in a really tough state because, I mean, no one wants to see nations become a police state where you're always under surveillance. There's armed guards there, even military deployed throughout just your own people. No one wants that atmosphere. It makes people tense. It's comes across the wrong way, even if it is for security guarantees. So this is a very difficult situation. I mean, Turkey's a little different. They're actually used to this. It happens actually a lot. But for the rest of us, or maybe we're not so accustomed to attacks or this kind of warfare, because that's really what it is. It is really a big burden, and it does impinge on our freedoms that we're used to having. And the only example I can think of would be Israel, where they have to live like this all the time, and the people accept it. But even then, it doesn't stop people all the time. But they do usually get stopped much quicker than what we've seen in the West. So it is going to be interesting to see just how people react to this, different governments. If I know Germany, they just passed a law a couple of weeks ago where the army can be deployed now at home in times of emergencies and work with the police. It'll be interesting to see if there's more of that, just more actual soldiers on the streets in Europe, in America, other places patrolling. And it just makes for a very uneasy atmosphere to live in.
Yeah, this Fox story says that the body count is expected to keep climbing in the wake of the attack at one of the world's busiest airports. And there were three suicide bombers. They opened fire with AK-47s before blowing themselves up as police engaged them. I was thinking about those police officers. Pretty noble, but you're putting your life on the line to take down a terrorist, especially when he has a suicide vest. They say, as if to underscore Turkey's determination to carry on in the face of a growing threat, the airport reopened Wednesday, just hours after the dead and some 239 wounded were carried away and glass and debris were cleared. Can you imagine that? Going to work the next day if you work at that airport, trying to carry on like everything's normal. You'd be looking at everybody that came in and out of your shop or your, you know, whatever you were doing there. You'd be really looking at people, trying to just gauge what's happening. Or if you had a fly through there today, how eerie to walk through a place. I'm sure certain areas are not open, but to walk past some of those places and know that just yesterday people were standing there just like you and now they're dead or wounded. That's such a strange feeling.
Yeah, it's surreal, and I think it makes people think a lot more than you normally would. I mean, all of us, when you go to the airport, you're mainly concerned, like, well, can I beat this person in line, get through security, get down, be comfortable, and hopefully the plane gets in early. But not a lot of us think of our safety or our lives on the line when we go to airports, and especially a place like Istanbul, where it's a key hub between the Middle East and Europe. A lot of flights go through there, international flights. There's a lot of different people that come through there, racially and ethnically. So it makes it difficult to trust people and to really kind of get a handle on what's going on. And ISIS does have a history. They try to play one side off each other in Turkey because there's different terrorist groups for different ethnic groups that have committed attacks. And ISIS has tried to pit those against one another just to destabilize the country. But this seems like they just went after Turkey, like the government and the people. They didn't target any special interests. So it is interesting, the motivation behind the attack, because Turkey's on the northern border of their Islamic State, as they call it, and they've been losing some ground there to Syrian forces and Turkish forces too, who were deployed there. So it does make the people of Turkey think, I guess, whether they want to commit to the war. How do they want to help Israel and these other people when you have a Sunni terrorist group trying to kill you. I don't know. It just makes a very difficult situation for the people in Turkey to find like a safe path politically too.
CIA chief Brennan yesterday made some comments after the Turkish attack and had some warnings there for America. He said, you look at what happened in the Turkish airport. He said these were suicide vests. It's not that difficult to actually construct and fabricate a suicide vest. So if you have a determined enemy and individuals who are not concerned about escape, that they are going into it with the sense that they are going to die, that really does complicate your strategy in terms of preventing attacks. He said, I'd be surprised if ISIS is not trying to carry out that kind of attack in the United States. So it's interesting, too. I saw a comment a few months back from somebody, I don't remember exactly who it was, just a commentator on a talk show. And one of the points they brought out was that we're becoming so used to terrorism, if you could put it that way, that people just kind of pick up and move along. And that's exactly what's happening here in Turkey. You know, they're getting back to business the next day. And I think we've talked about that in the past, how you start running out of dates, you know, 9/11 and some of these other dates that are infamous because of terror attacks. You know, there's been so many, even this last, say, year, 2 years, an attack happens like this, and then they'll reference a couple of other attacks, and I find myself going, oh, right, I forgot about that one. But that, you know, whatever one it was, that was a big one. I think about Paris, I think about 9/11, but then you've got the Brussels attack, you've got, you know, this one, of course, the Orlando one. I mean, you start throwing those all in there, the terrorism is just, it's just on the rise, it seems like.
Yeah, it really is. The frequency is just off the charts, I think. I mean, and these aren't places, we've talked before about Iraq and how many terrorist attacks they have there and other nations, but we're talking about America, Europe, places where it was almost untouchable, unless it was a really big attack or something that was been in the works for years. But now we're having these lone wolf attacks, low technology. In a recent book I read on Iraq and the war on terror, Zarqawi, and so who he founded the methods of that ISIS uses. When the Marines took a city in Iraq, they found a suicide vest factory, essentially, where they make bombs and everything. And that you can build those with almost no electricity, like no power, no nothing. You can just build on your own. And they had a whole factory producing these out, turning them out for people to have. And it is just a pretty terrible business that they're getting into. And it's they can manufacture and export it around the world. And it's not hard for people in other countries to do it too, to participate in the same way. So it is going to be difficult to stop them in the first place because they're unsophisticated. It's hard to track.
Well, like Brennan pointed out, if the perpetrator is not concerned about their own physical life, that's hard to stop.
Right.
It's like a kamikaze pilot.
Yeah.
They're coming to die. And so that's usually the big deterrent, is that people are afraid of getting caught or getting injured or dying or something. But when you have people that are in some ways hoping to die, that's really difficult to deal with.
Yeah, actually, I did a little research on some of the recent terror attacks in Turkey. A lot of them are suicide bombers. In fact, most of them. Not all of them are ISIS. There's some from Kurdistan terrorist groups and a Marxist one too. But just looking at the types of people who were the suicide bombers, there was a pregnant woman, like a lot of women, actually. There were, most of them were women, I think. And then you used to have like young men. Other places you've had children or teenagers.
That's another factor that you bring out there. You can't look and say, oh, that's probably a suicide bomber, because they don't all fit the same profile. You would never expect a pregnant woman to do something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is obviously why they're doing it, or a child.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of the cruelest forms of attacks, where you either threaten people, like you kidnap their family and you force them to do what you say, or you'll, or there'll be consequences for their family members, or they're just an ideological believer and they'll go along with it. But it's hard to fight. Well, it's almost impossible to fight something that's in the mind to an extent where someone will die for it. That's true on both sides, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. And the only way you can do that is to fight it with another idea over time, or just to completely annihilate it, like we did in through certain wars. World War II, we just used overwhelming force to defeat the Nazis, because there were, or even the Japanese too, the kamikaze pilots. So when it gets to when the warfare gets to that point, it's not enough just to ignore it. Like, I think that what the West is really doing with ISIS, like, there's a terror attack, they'll give a few speeches, but like you mentioned, they'll pick up the pieces and move on and not really take tangible solutions to stop it at the source. But when you're dealing with people where you can influence women, pregnant women, people born in a different nation, they've lived their whole lives to make these attacks, it's you have to start taking a lot more drastic action.
It's going to be interesting to see just, you know, what happens here in the near future. But anyway, especially with the Olympics coming up, people, all kinds of people traveling through multiple airports around the world. And I would think they're going to have to, if nothing else, expect long delays, because, you know, they have to be careful, especially when you look at these attacks here recently. So that was the big story over the last 24 hours or so, and I'm sure there'll be more coming out about that. And you can find updates about that at thetrumpet.com and right here at kpcg.fm as well. People want to be safe. Obviously, they don't want to get into difficulties like this. This story is from financeyahoo.com. The 30 safest places to raise a child are found in only 12 states. So for the rest of you, if you're not in those 12... They say the 30 safest cities to raise a child in the U.S. are found in these 12 states, according to a new report from home security system ranking website Safewise. The safest place in America to raise a kid is Carmel, Indiana. That's what they claim anyway. Safewise said the city puts an emphasis on its smallest residents and infrastructure, including award-winning schools and exceptionally high graduation rates. Second place goes to Fishers, Indiana. Indiana is the place.
That's the hot spot.
If you want to be safe, go to Indiana. They say due to its low crime rate, parents are able to enjoy a variety of activities with their little ones, like festivals and community family game nights. That's interesting. I don't know that I've ever heard of that. You know, maybe like within a certain group, like a church would have something like that, but like a whole community having a game night, that's interesting. They say other places in the top five are Greenwich, Connecticut, Irvine, California, Middletown Township, New Jersey. More than half of the safest places on the list are in New Jersey and Connecticut. Kind of surprised me with New Jersey, I guess, but not for any particular reason. I just would have thought
right. It
would be somewhere a little more less populated. So anyway, they don't have the list of all of the states, but if you live in Indiana, California, New Jersey, or Connecticut, you have some safe places. But like anything, I bet there's a lot of unsafe places in those states too, especially California.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah, it is. I don't know what all the metrics they use to gauge these, but I assume most of these are pretty small communities, isolated, but I doubt you'll find any big cities on that list.
Right.
Just because, I mean, that's just the way the demographics work. The more people, the more crime. So, and with New Jersey, I was surprised too, especially when you have a hockey team called the Devils. Surprised that it's that safe of a place, but they have the numbers to back it up.
I guess so. Yeah, those are some of those safe places. But again, I think it depends on the community you're in. Within, I mean, even like say the area we're in here in Central Oklahoma, there's some really good areas. There's some areas that are a little more suspect. I mean, you can drive in certain places in Oklahoma City, and like you can go block to block, and it can go from quite nice to quite bad to quite nice in a matter of a couple of blocks.
Oh, yeah.
Just based on what's around there. I don't know the exact statistics, but just looking at what's happening on those blocks, you get a sense that keep rolling along here. Yeah. I don't want to stop here. I remember years ago, the most dangerous place was East St. Louis. I don't know if that still is the case, but I had a sociology class in college, and they studied East St. Louis and tried to figure out why it was so dangerous. And then, lo and behold, like a couple months later, I was driving through St. Louis, and my car broke down in East St. Louis. And I thought, oh, this is the end. But thankfully, I was able to get to a safe location and get it dealt with. But it was not a comfortable feeling, I'll tell you that. So anyway, there's some good communities out there, and everybody likes to be in those if they can. Abraham, you ever hear of Buddy Ryan? He was an assistant football coach, and I think a head coach for a while in the NFL.
The name sounds familiar, yeah. But I don't recount what team or if he was a good one or not.
Yeah, well, he was a defensive coordinator for the 1985 Chicago Bears, which is they're considered probably one of the best defenses of all time, and he had kind of a revolutionary system at that time. So he was famous for that. He also coached with the Eagles and a few other teams, and he died on I think it was Tuesday, Monday or Tuesday. And he was in his, I think he was 85, so lived a good long life, but they were remembering Buddy Ryan. He was a kind of an outspoken coach, and they had some of his best quotes here, some of his 10 greatest quotes. And so I thought it'd be funny to look at a couple of those. One of them, he was talking to about a guy that he worked with, Kevin Gilbride. They were assistant coaches together on the Houston Oilers, and they got into a fight. And instead of apologizing to Kevin Gilbride, he said, "Kevin Gilbride will be selling insurance in 2 years." So he didn't think much of his coaching ability, but apparently he thought he was good at selling insurance. their famous defense, I think it was called the 46 or something with 46 in there when he was with the Bears. And he said, "Some say the 46 is just an 8-man front. That's like saying Marilyn Monroe is just a girl." Fair enough.
Almost poetic.
Yeah. He also said, "Quarterbacks are overpaid, overrated, pompous, and must be punished." That was his defensive philosophy. So if you were, and I left out a couple of choice words there as well.
Right.
So if you were a quarterback, you knew he was coming for you. He was talking about one of the running backs on his team. He said, "Trade him for a six-pack. It doesn't even have to be cold." Well, thanks, coach.
Yeah.
What do you think? What do you think of your running back? Yeah, trade him for a six-pack. Doesn't even have to be cold. I love these coaches. They're not trying to be politically correct. They're just letting it rip. He said, "Football kickers are like taxi cabs. You can always go out and hire another one." True enough. Somebody, when he was coaching the Eagles, somebody asked him about their offensive strategy. And he's like, "Offense?" He said, "Our offense is for Randall Cunningham to make 5 big plays and we'll win." And so Randall Cunningham was their quarterback. He was one of those kind of run-pass quarterbacks. He made a lot of dynamic plays. So he didn't care too much about the strategy, just said make 5 big plays. He famously said, "If you listen to the fans, you'll be sitting up there with them." So he didn't care what the fans thought. And he talked about making roster cuts to his team. That's a very difficult thing. Guys are trying really hard, and eventually they get cut, you know, in training camp. And they asked him, you know, if it was difficult. He said, "It was so easy, my wife could have made them, and she doesn't even know these guys." Your whole career's just been taken away. Yeah. That's what the coach says. And then this is my favorite one. There was a roster of replacement players with the Eagles. I think it was probably during the strike season where they had replacement players for a while. And he said, "We might have the worst bunch of guys together we've ever seen as a football team. I don't know what anybody else has, but I'd trade mine with anybody, sight unseen." We're trying hard, coach.
Yeah.
Trade him for anybody. I don't even need to look at him. That's some of the wit and wisdom of Buddy Ryan, who died earlier this week. So kind of a humorous guy in some ways. I thought that was kind of an interesting story. A little lighter to lighten the mood. Always a lot of serious headlines, so it's good to have a couple of lighter ones. This one is from yesterday, our last little headline here. It's from the Washington Post, and the title of the column is "Dear Science, Why Aren't Apes Evolving into Humans?" It's a good question.
It is, yeah.
It's a question people ask. And so this is their response to that. And they write, "We hate to be the ones to break it to you, but you are an ape." Did you know that? That you are an ape, Abraham?
Oh, I know it now. Yeah.
They say, so it's this whole typical write-up that you'd expect, you know, with throwing out grandiose numbers. This happened 10,000 years ago and then 10 million years ago, and as if they had been there to see it. But they say this. This is an interesting little paragraph. They say, "But as hominins, tool use got more sophisticated. Their ecological niches expanded. Species didn't have to choose between having big molars for chewing seeds and sharp canines for ripping meat. With tools, they could partially break the food before eating it and consume both." So they would have us believe that these humanoid-type beings developed some sort of crude tools and then decided that they could have different types of teeth. Have you ever had that happen in your life where you just decided like you were going to grow something different on your body?
Just when I tried to grow a beard once in my life, but that's about the only experience I've had with that.
It's just as if, you know, you're supposed to, apparently we're supposed to just believe this. I'm like, okay, well, where's your evidence of that? Well, you know. Because the whole thing is the idea that they developed certain tools, therefore they didn't have to do other things that they had needed previously, and so they just decided to change. When have you ever seen that? You know, now granted, I mean, if you want to talk about just negative adaptation, you could talk about that. People don't need to walk as far, so inevitably people get a little fatter.
Right.
That is adapting.
Yeah.
Your body is changing based upon the circumstances you're putting it in. But this is it's just an extraordinary statement to make something like that, oh, we know this happened. That's a godlike prerogative. Were you there? How many ever years ago? How do you know this happened?
Yeah, it is interesting the method they take, because with anything else, they would show you like, well, we did this experiment and this, and it proves that gravity works every time an apple falls from a tree. Something along those lines. But with evolution, they can't do that because there's no fossil record. There's no modern evidence of anything resembling the processes they talk about. Every adaptation or mutation usually is negative, where the species gets weaker and it dies, rather than it resulting in a stronger species, which is what their theory is. So, and even then, they pick such an obscure and ridiculous point for evidence about your teeth. I mean, that's fine, but let's talk about the millions of other changes it would have to happen between a gorilla and a human. I mean, the differences, I mean, they might say like, oh, DNA is similar, like we look maybe similar, some people more than others maybe, but there is, but the biological differences are astronomical. I mean, just some, one scientist, he's evolutionary skeptic, where he just, his main work is showing that it's actually false. And he was just going on about how the differences between just the eyes, between different species who they say evolved, like a cow or like a manatee became a cow, etc. The differences are so astronomical, there would have to be so many changes, it's impossible. And it would have to happen at once or else it would die because it couldn't see or yeah. Whatever the changes are. So it's the assertions they make are something out of science fiction. And that's, and as we look more at evolution, that's exactly what it is. It's science fiction. It's not actually science. And they're giving nature, this force that changes species over times, the characteristics of God, when actually it's God that created everything, and that if things do adapt or if things change, it's him who does it.
Yeah. Really, just amazing how there is no hard facts. Now they would tell you there are, and they would, you know, you can read this whole article, the Washington Post, and they throw out a lot of terms and start talking big numbers, you know, 10 million years ago. But it's just a fancy story, and not a good one either. When have you ever seen that? Can I give my cat a little hammer and will he decide he doesn't need sharp teeth anymore?
Right.
I mean, that's what they're saying. And I know their response would be like, well, you know, it takes billions of years. Well, okay, sure. he can keep the hammer and pass it down to the kittens and they'll use it as well. They can't hold it. It's hard to hold.
Right. I did see a commercial actually where they were talking about if cats had thumbs, mm-hmm. what they would start doing. And it was actually pretty terrifying. So I'm just glad that will never happen.
They would just scratch you with one additional claw.
Right.
That would be the extent of it.
Yeah.
But anyway, you can go to thetrumpet.com. There's a lot of good write-ups about what science can't discover about the human mind. And there is a real difference there. I mean, Genesis talks about it, Genesis 1. But of course, people don't. A lot of times, if they're pro-evolution, they are very anti-Bible. You have to kind of choose one way or the other. So anyway, interesting. It's just amazing the authority that they speak with. And, you know, they say, we hate to break it to you, but you are an ape. Oh, okay. Well, that's convenient.
Yeah, I'm an ape, but not an ape.
That's right.
There's a difference.
There's a one-letter difference there.